we're back again. My name, Long John Neville. We're around a lot of times during the day. And I've invited a good friend of mine who one time we worked together, and he's been on with me at this station many times. His name, Gene Shepherd. And Gene is responsible for a lot of words in Playboy and in books, and certainly millions of words on radio. He's a broadcaster, actor, author, and in fact, you're rather fortunate if you didn't have the fin to go out and buy the hardcover book. You can go for an ace now, actually a little less. You can go for 6 bits, 75 cents, and you can have the book. And I'll tell you one thing, not because he's here, it's really a great book. It's titled In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And, you know, this is Shepherd at his best. So we hope that you're able to pick up your copy, and it's a bantam book. Well, let me see. We were sitting, no, you were sitting, judging the beauty contest.
Oh, John. John, you're an evil man.
Yes, sir.
You know, I think that's one of the reasons why you're so successful.
Because I'm evil.
I think evil men win in the end. They always do.
Really? I thought it was the nice guy.
Oh, that's the old days.
Really? Oh, no more?
Sure. We all know that now evil pays off almost as well as push-ups.
Well, push-ups do nothing except give you muscle. And then what can you do? You can go over to a guy who is weak but wealthy and has barbells, and he can't lift them up to let the maid dust underneath him, so you can pick up a
John,
dish for lifting the barbells. That's all you can do it with muscle.
How long has it been since you kicked sand in the face of a bully at the beach?
I was always the guy with the sand in my eyes.
You were the guy with the girl on the blanket?
That's right, and he took my girl away from me.
The Charles Atlas student came over and kicked the sand in your face?
That's right. And I wound up being a Howard Bea of the night people. See, I understand a young lady called you today because she called me afterwards and she wanted to know what my sleep habits were. I just was wondering, isn't that a little personal?
Well, yes, in some ways.
Right.
It depends on what she asks about your sleep.
I said, well, she inquired.
I mean, whether it's a solo, I see.
She told me that she had talked to you about a half an hour before she talked to me.
Yes, that's right.
From town and country.
She asked me whether or not I thought, whether I knew anybody who suffered from insomnia.
That's right. That's her opening line with me, too. I think she had it on tape.
Yeah, and I said, what do you mean suffer? I think people who have insomnia are fortunate because they sleep less than most people, and hence they live more lives. They live more time.
I wish I could have called you first and gotten the line and given it to her myself. It's a beautiful line.
Well, I think it's true. I think a guy who sleeps 12 hours a day literally sleeps half of his life away. Actually sleeps half. There he is. Good morning.
Nice to see you.
Thanks.
Nice you could get up.
Just woke up now, yes.
Sam Fratello.
Well, we're just talking about insomnia. He looks like a man that does not suffer from it.
No.
I have Kushneritis, which you know what that is.
I see.
It's right out there. I just brought it in.
Oh, is that you? Want to sit in?
Well, that's one of them Armenians, right?
No. Bob Kushner. Robert Kushner. You stand.
Sure.
You don't still
stand. He's an editor. He's a writer.
He's a managing editor. I don't know what that means.
It's the worst kind. I deal with him all the time.
How are you doing?
Fine.
Well, I'm glad that you could join us, too.
Well, I'm honored.
Here we are, all of us, and now we'll bow our head in a moment of... And then
in a few moments, the spirit will appear in the table and blow the bugle.
That's right, and we'll be in business. The trumpet. It's never a
the
bugle.
Trumpet.
It's a trumpet when you're talking about spiritualism.
Isn't that the Hindu gaff?
Oh, no. That's done by many people in the 80s and the 70s right here in New York. There are many spiritualist meetings that are conducted right here in Manhattan, and check this light of the place down.
Well, John, I've heard your show described as a form of spiritualist meeting.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Kind of a mystical gathering of free spirits of one kind or another every night. And they commune, and mostly with their navels.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of exciting.
Do you know, did you have the guru on, or what is it? What's his name?
The guru was here today.
Yeah, today. He was in the building.
Maharishi Mahesh, I think it's Maharishi Guru.
And everybody's going to him.
Guess who he sent down to interview him this morning? Reverend David Poland.
Yes.
One religionist talks to another religionist.
You know, I've been listening to him, and everything he says sounds like the stuff that used to be on the bottom of the calendars that my mother had. You know, be kind.
Trying to tell him. Okay.
Yes.
Things like think good thoughts.
Was that from Father John's medicine?
No, actually, no, it was St. Joseph's white salve.
Oh, yes, I used to sell it myself.
You can't get it past me.
I used to sell it myself, and that's the first time I got my Boy Scout knife.
Well, Jared, I kind of lean 16, towards...
16 of those metal containers of the great salve, which took the pain from a bunion, and also if you burn yourself or scald yourself with hot water or anything like that, instead of using ordinary butter, you'd use white salve.
And that's, of course, that's cloverine white salve.
Hey, you're right. You're right. It is cloverine.
That's right. It was
tried to get a Daisy BB gum, but never could.
Oh, no, I went for the pony.
You did? Yeah. Never made it, though,
no,
did
you? No, of course
you?
Not.
Did
didn't
you at
even
least
get the syrup? No.
I was going to say the whole hardest, but... You never made it, huh?
No, you're talking...
Have you got any more of the salve left? Because I could, you know, buy a few...
John, I sent off that coupon that appeared in the Hearst paper in Chicago. You know, the Chicago Herald Examiner, I believe it was in those days. And it was in the funny papers. You know, and at the bottom of the funnies, it said, kids, win a pony. Sell white cloverine salve. And this is one of the first traumatic experiences I ever had in the world of salesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that moment, after I got my white cloverine salve, and I made my first tour of the neighborhood. And, you know, they had this little blurb that said, your friends and neighbors will be excitedly awaiting the arrival of you with your white cloverine salve because they all need it for the lumbago.
Mm.
They used me at I never have met anybody with lumbago, but I went out with my white cloverine salve, and the temperature was 5 below.
And a pony in your mind.
Pony in my mind, and I went up to Mr. Bruner, knocked on the door, and I said, I've got white cloverine salve for sale. He looked at me. Don't want none. And the door closed. I went next door. And there was Mrs. Anderson. I knocked on the door and I said, I'm here with your white cloverine salve. They even sent you a salesmanship booklet. It says, never say to people, do you want white cloverine salve? You say, I'm here with your white cloverine salve.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me and she says, white what? I said, cloverine salve. She said, I thought you said oleomargarine. She says, what do you do with it? I says, well, it's for a lumbago. She says, well, he doesn't live here anymore.
Gosh, I only saw the Saturday Evening Post.
As a matter of fact, my old man got so bugged, he sent the rest of the case back to the white cloverine salve people. And when he discovered that I was trying for a pony, he gave this long look at me and says, if you win a pony, I'll break your neck.
Did you live in an apartment at the time?
We lived just about.
Did you ever read his book, In God We Trust?
No, I haven't.
Really, it is excellent. It is excellent.
I got the original hardcover.
Yeah, we got the hardcover. Yeah. This is the paperback, and not because Gene is here, but it's really a... Did you ever read any of his things in
the Playboy? Playboy stuff, no. Yes.
Well, a lot of this...
The manuscript of this novel was first seen by Playboy, and the pieces you read in Playboy... chapters out of the novel.
Oh, I see.
That's the way it
was. They never said that in Playboy.
Yes, they did.
Did they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, two of the chapters.
Not in the centerfold.
No, they don't say anything in the center. The centerfold says all it has to say. You just shake that magazine and it comes flopping out.
That's right.
You don't even have to open Playboy.
Do you tape these or do you write them? I've often wondered whether...
Oh, no, they're written.
They are written.
Have you ever seen a tape transcribed?
Yeah, no.
Well,
but I've heard you, too, you know... For hours at a stretch.
No, you know one of the...
It sounds right.
Well, you see, that's something that I've always aimed at in writing, is to get... I feel that writing is a substitute for speech. No matter how you write, you're really substituting for a man talking to you. Even in the case of a so-called classical writing, you're using a kind of...
It's not supposed to be conversation, though.
No, that's not the same as speech. Conversation implies a give and take. It's a monologue.
Mm.
And I have worked in my writing. It's taken me a long time, actually, a professional writing, 10 to 12 years, to attempt to get the same feel as a man literally, actually talking to you. And
yeah,
so a lot of people reading it, they say, well, you must have taped that. But this is the last thing you can do.
Well, I thought my first thought when I read some of the Playboy stuff is that you taped it first, and then got a transcript, and then went
not
over.
Not a bit of it. No. As a matter of fact, the way I write, if I'm going to write, say, a short story that doesn't have any connection with something before and after a specific piece, I'll think of an idea, and it's usually a story that I may have tried on the air just to get the feel of it myself. And then after that, I'll first write a very loose running, I suppose you can call it a draft.
Mm-hmm.
And then I begin to expand it. And then after I expand the draft until it gets to be maybe 500 pages, I cut it back to the original eight.
Eight pages from 500?
Yeah.
You must not worry about your own feelings.
Oh, no.
Cut,
I'm ruthless. I really have
a problem. I'm very happy to give whatever I write to somebody else, you know, to another editor who can chop it down. And it hurts me to see somebody else cut it, but I'd rather him do it than me.
Well, you know, I found that many writers are that way, I'm fortunate in that I work so hard at editing my work that I have never yet had a piece appear in Playboy, and I've had maybe 15 pieces so far in Playboy, major short stories, and I've never yet had one piece that the editors edited.
Really?
I've never had one word removed.
No, that's remarkable. But usually an editor, because I am one now, will edit it just because
I say that in the introductions. Now, you don't have to do that.
Just in case minds have wandered 3 minutes ago.
That's right. You're talking down to you now.
No. But
he
editors
too, Jamie, really.
No, really, editors do have a tendency, regardless of the perfection of the prose that they get, they still want to get their blue pencil.
Well, I have a remarkable editor. It's a guy at Playboy named Murray Fisher. He's a senior editor there. And Murray said, and when we first started all this work, and he found that I was that way. I don't like to see myself writing something that secretly inside my mind, if I were an editor, I would cut out. Really that way, you know. So when he discovered that, Murray said, look, he said, you just do it, and he said, if I want any cuts made for space problems that may conceivably arise, mm-hmm. he says, I'll simply send your proofs back and you do it. He says, I don't want to mess with it. He said, because the rhythm of speech that you get into your work is something that you can do. He said, I can't do it. He said, yeah.
I wonder how Thomas Wolfe felt then when, you know, he gave a manuscript to his agent, his editor, Max Perkins. You know, 10,000 pages and had it cut down to the bare bones.
Well, I don't think what Max Perkins did really was editing. What I thought he did was organizing. I think he took a whole mass of stuff and just simply...
threw them downstairs or something.
Well, he just cut out, like, reams of it, but didn't change it. To me, editing is changing the beat and the rhythm.
But also cutting or condensing, in some cases enlarging or embellishing. Lots of things sneaky editors do.
That's a good question. I'd like to, you know, I think there's two kinds of editing. I think there is the cutting and the snipping editor, and then there's the editor who says, why don't you use Hot Diggity Dog instead of Oh Shaw?
Well, that's what...
That's a writer. Really.
Right. Well, Ross of The New Yorker did that. He was known. He was, I guess most people consider him one of the greatest editors, but... he would do a lot more than either cut or condense in some way. He would change words.
Well, personally, Bob, I think this is why that magazine always has had a kind of, I enjoyed a lot of stuff that's been in The New Yorker, but they've always had a kind of homogenous sound.
That's very true.
As a writer, that would bug me. Writing for Playboy, for example, mm-hmm. I'll appear in one part of the magazine, and on the next part, right next to me, there'll be a short story by, say, Herb Gold.
Yeah.
And
they want that difference. But
yeah, they want that constant dynamic difference between each piece.
Well, the New Yorker, of course, they've got a stable of people over there, and when you're a New Yorker writer, when you're typed as a New Yorker writer, you're always a New Yorker writer.
Yeah, it's usually a lady with three names or an Italian.
Well, of course, what bothers me most about New Yorker stories is that I have to wait until the end to find out who wrote it.
Not really.
You can always look.
Yeah.
That's cheating. You're supposed to figure out in the first couple of paragraphs who wrote it.
Well, you can always tell a John Cheever story. His story is almost always concerned with the same people. And a typical ending of a John Cheever story is... and the 7:15 pulled into Wyandotte Circle, Mr. Smothers slowly mounted the steps.
Period.
period.
Yes.
And you can see, you can read the whole story. You don't even have to read
That's
it.
That's right.
This whole thing, you know, Mr. Smothers sad, Mr. Smothers, his life has been wasted. Now he's in love with the babysitter.
You could always tell a S.J. Perelman story, too, by the, usually it's a news clip, as
yeah,
a lead.
At the beginning.
Yeah, that he takes off.
Well, Perelman's style is really different than anybody else.
But I'd be disturbing you, Mr. Coxner, if I'd ask you for just a moment to permit me to take care of some business.
Well, that's still being filed by large numbers of lady librarians all across the country under religious books.
I wouldn't know.
I'm serious. I'm right next to Mahatma Gandhi.
In the Valley of the Dolls?
It's religion, all right.
David Poling, the great religious... Do you know Dave Poling?
A
great humor writer?
No.
Oh, Reverend Poling is a...
He's a swinger.
Really, no, he's a delightful gentleman. He's really done an awful lot for the work that he's keenly interested in.
That's true. Very true.
Right?
Absolutely. Amen.
If you would describe the work,
what is his work?
Oh. I've talked with him for 4 or 5 hours and was never able to discover what it is.
He's done a lot
of work. He's dedicated
more than most people would put in
just
for that kind of money.
Sounds a like Judge Puffles.
He's very loyal.
He is. That's a wonderful word. I'm glad that you employed that tonight to describe the great David Poling. We're all very big fans of his. And some night we hope that you will be able to join us when he is delivering one of his spiritual messages.
Yeah. Well, I like a spiritual message.
He speaks with tongues.
Yes, he does.
I like rye bread, too.
All right, we'll have some of that a little later.
Mustard on a good spiritual message, marinate it.
That's right. You have it all made. Mr. Kochner, this is your golden opportunity.
Is it to do what? I was just stroking my mustache.
Well, that's about all you can do, I guess, if you...
No, we were mentioning during the break and something I couldn't understand about the way Playboy structures its magazine, that they seem, no matter what kind of material is written, they always put in front of it, say, Gene Shepard, and then there's a slash and it says, humor. And then some Herbert Gold, / fiction. Somebody else, / article. It seemed to me that anybody who reads it is going to know without telling me. I don't have to be told that you're going to write humor. I don't care. I'll read it and I'll judge for myself whether it's humor or one thing or another. Why would they do a thing like that?
Well, I really don't have any answer to that, Bob. I've argued. In fact, that point has come up a couple times in discussion with my editor as to what they're going to put over a piece. And I think it goes back to the early days of the magazine. It's a thing that was put in very early when Playboy consisted in the earliest days. Now, if you've ever seen, you know, some of the early Playboy issues, like issue number 1 or 2, are really expensive collector items today. They really, because...
I don't even recall them anymore.
There weren't many printed, and of course, Playboy's gone on to become a worldwide phenomenon, and it is really a valuable collector's item now, but if you go back to those magazines, you'll see that they have these blocks, but the reason they used them then was because the magazine was new, and they couldn't even afford, new writing. And so they would publish a classic.
Yeah, the Ribald's Tales.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they would put things over the top, more or less to describe why they're using it. They would have a Ribald classic, and it would be
right.
De Maupassant. Then they would have something like Great Interviews,
yeah,
and it would be a reprint of an interview that appeared somewhere.
Of course, in the early days, nobody much cared what was written in Playboy.
Well, see, Hefner's a very sentimental type, curiously enough. He really is, and a thing like that...
I heard him described in many ways, but
that never
sentimental.
No.
I'm sorry, I know him very well. It runs through his magazine.
Where do you find sentimentality in Playboy?
Well, have you ever read my stuff?
That's you, it's Gene Shepard.
No, he's publishing it.
Yes, but he's publishing Gene Shepard.
Yeah, but the New Yorker wouldn't.
All right, the New Yorker may not. Now, New Yorker publishes Woody
They're
Allen.
They're but not sentimental.
They both publish Woody Allen.
They do?
Yeah,
I don't think. I think there's no, absolutely no. To me, Allen is hardcore Gagsville. And to me, that has nothing to do with human emotions or one way or the other. It's a whole series of he-she jokes.
Right, but they're great jokes.
Some
are.
He deals with reminiscences from time to time. I don't know how true they are, but they always seem to be based somewhere in the past.
Well,
maybe that's sentimentality.
Mm-hmm. No, we're not discussing my work. We're discussing Hefner. And I think that in my work, I think, is anti-sentimental, as a matter of fact, if you ever really read it, you realize that it's a put-down of all the things which most people think it stands for. Mm. It's anti-nostalgic writing.
Does Hefner know that?
Oh, sure. Well, he loves it.
Let me ask you something.
Does this impression get up at Hefner as this kind of ignorant slob?
Not ignorant slob. No.
Good heavens, no. Nobody could do what he's done.
No, I mean, he understands what he's doing, too.
Yeah, but he's a... No, look, the impression that I have of Hugh Hefner is one of the great business minds of our time in the journalistic field. A man has become a multimillionaire, not only with a magazine, but with merchandising every possible aspect of the magazine. He's taken a formula that's been around, you know, basic formula, girls and all, that started out, and today they pay more for fiction than anybody else in the country.
May I say this? I'm sorry, Sandy. You know, I think this is a subtle form of put-down because you
never... It's not a put-down.
Yes, it is, because you would never say about Harold Ross that he's a great businessman, because after all, that magazine became a fabulous commercial success during his day, Ross.
As editor.
Well, he created the magazine, just like Hef created the Playboy. But the kind of subtle put-down of a Hefner would be, well, he's a great businessman. He was essentially and began as a man who created a magazine. And that magazine became successful because it was a good magazine.
Well, what made it good at the time?
It filled a need.
It's good now. But
it was good then.
I had, until about 2 years ago, you talked about the early issues of Playboy. I had a classic collector's item which somebody swiped from me, including the portfolio of nude shots of Anita Ekberg. Remember that? Sculptor.
Don't confuse the magazine with its photography.
But originally, didn't it get the coverage on the basis of the girls, originally?
I'm sorry, there were 1,000. This is one of the great myths around. There were dozens of girly magazines around at the time. And by the way, even magazines that went much further as far as nudity than Playboy.
That's true. Right.
So the idea that it made it on the girls, it only made it with people who didn't read it. And so the people who read the magazine know that they didn't buy it for the girls, but the people who saw the magazine and didn't read it assumed it was the girls.
Did Hefner start off, the apocryphal story that he started off with like $1,000 or $2,000, do you have any idea if that is really true?
Yes, I'll tell you exactly how it started. Hefner was working, he worked a couple of places in Chicago, and by the way, most of the people who created the magazine are from and around Chicago. My old friend Shelley Silverstein, Leroy Neiman, the artist.
Spekkowski, is he from Chicago?
No. Speck came with the magazine comparatively late in its career. The magazine already was a raging success when Speck joined it. Hef, of course, Jack Kessie, the editor under Hefner. And when he started this magazine, Hefner was working at the time, at the immediate time, he was working for Esquire in the Chicago office. And he had a lot of, he felt that the magazine was old-fashioned. Esquire, its constant reiteration of the Fitzgerald, the Hemingway.
Yeah.
It was in love with the 30s, which, by the way, it still pretty much remains if you read the magazine. And he said, this is not the 30s, and there are a lot of writers writing around today that just aren't being published because they're today. So Hef got, he had around $6,000 of his own money. He borrowed another two, and he created the magazine, and the first issues were laid out in the living room of his house on the northwest side of Chicago, all over the floor. He pinned them up.
Oh.
And you know he works that way today?
I read that, yes.
In his room, in the Hefner mansion, his room, really, in a sense, is it's just where he does his work. And you see all over the walls, anytime you visit Hef, he's got the next issue of Playboy, the one he's working on currently, pinned on the walls.
Same way as I do in, I don't have a mansion, 23-room penthouse right next to Bob Kochner's 63-room penthouse. I have all these tapes up there, all pinned up on the wall, ready to be...
A man of such vast output as you, John, we've got to have
it. Jack Keane is just ready to put them all together.
Vast output.
We're back again. Robert Kochner is with us, Sanford Teller, and Gene Shepherd. My name, Long John Neville. So I'd like to remind you, although I haven't seen it, somebody told me that this Sunday there's a piece in the New York Sunday News by Ben Gross, who's the dean of radio and TV editors, the man who wrote the book I Looked and I Listened, that was published by Random House. And And the story is going to be in Sunday's paper.
Ben is a real New York landmark.
Oh, he is.
He really is.
Great man.
He's of that whole crew that New York has produced these fantastic columnists over the years. Guys like O.O. McIntyre, mm-hmm. Gross.
FBA.
Yeah, that whole crowd. He's one of them.
You know, I was talking the other day with somebody, a young man. See, this will even hurt you, Bob.
Younger than I am.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, no.
You know.
No, I know.
And, you know, we usually talk about young men, you know, of 30, 35, but I'm talking about a younger man. And he was mentioning something about ambitions. And then another young man came in to see me today, Duke Osler. That's Will's son.
Yes.
And he is a reporter on a Bridgeport newspaper. And I guess Duke is about... in 22, 23, something like that, and a couple of summers. Duke used to work for me over at O'Warren.
Yeah, I remember that.
He'd come in during the summer months and work at nights. And
with Paris Flamand.
That's right, yeah, with Paris Flamand and a couple of the others around. But the point I'm trying to make is this, that it seems so many guys, and maybe because I am the older member of the group tonight, every night I'm on, I'm the older member of the group.
You're getting to notice that.
That's right. So many guys make excuses. You're talking about Hefner. This is what reminds me. Always, you know, a lot of parents, and I think the parents make this mistake. They'll tell their children, their sons in particular, you got to crawl before you walk. And, you know, you've got it made. You know, you've got your whole life ahead of you. Well, I imagine that some guy... 70 or 75, who may be seated opposite me as a guest one night, and he would say to me, you've got your whole life ahead of you. You're a kid. Well, I am a kid compared to a guy 75. But I think that Hefner was a man, who I've never met, incidentally. I think Hefner had something that only successful guys have, and that is a drive to do it. He was not going to be conned or lulled into saying, you know, look, take it easy. You know, you crawl before you walk.
Start small.
Start small. And you're young. You got the whole world ahead of you. Mm. Well, I wouldn't even say this to a 16-year-old kid that he has the world ahead of him. Because today, when we had Robert Metz on, who is with the New York Times. He writes a financial column for the New York Times 5 days a week. And he was on the other night with us. And he was telling me some things that were pretty exciting to me. That in the mutual fund market today, there are about three or four guys. There's one rather old man who has been successful in the last year and a half. He's 32. The other two guys, one is 25 and one is 27. Now, I'm not talking about guys who got a few bucks together to invest. I'm talking about guys who have successful mutual funds. So there you sit opposite me. This older man, this managing editor... And instead of being out there hustling and, you know, you'll wind up being a Sanford Teller.
I plan to retire in 5 years.
If only that were true. You know how fortunate he would be.
John, he's gone far. Remember one thing. You're missing the point here, John. He is on the Long John Show.
That's right.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's true.
Four men who've been on the Long John Show in the last 5 years have been assassinated. So don't, I would not make it. It's true.
I think the... wait a minute, Sandy. I think to be assassinated is the ultimate compliment.
Assassination instead of murder. You're right.
You do not assassinate Charlie Applebaum.
That's right. You kill him.
That's all I'll be going out with. But I think this is one of the reasons why there are Hefners and you know, there's another guy that I think of, and don't, you know, say just because his old man had a few bucks. Actually, there wasn't a fortune. It was a fortune compared to what we may have at the present time. And that's Howard Hughes. You know, the whole Howard Hughes thing, I think, was about $100,000
or $150,000. There wasn't much money there at all. That's right.
Compared to what he made of it.
Yeah, he took it and made it.
Now, this was a guy that didn't play games. He was going to make it. And... whether that was a hang-up with him or what it was, I don't know. I'm not trained.
But you know, John, when you use...
May I
interrupt you here for a minute? You use... you know, I think that Hefner and people like that type, Hefner and Hughes, Howard Hughes, that type...
Henry Luce.
These people are... When you say make it... Now, I think the average ordinary walking around citizen, when you use the word make it...
You think money?
He thinks in terms of money.
I don't.
No, I'm talking... No, we got to explain terms here. that a guy like Hefner, to him, and it's going to sound very strange to a lot of people who think that way, money is of no consequence to him. It's the game he's playing. He's so fascinated and excited by all the things he does, and he does them so well. He is truly, by the way, a business genius. He knows how to do these things, and so the natural increment of it is money. It's like a gambler. He plays with chips. He doesn't think in terms of money. And so a guy like Hughes he loves this whole big game. In a way, they're very much like the character that Ian Fleming created. They're James Bonds. These are adventurers. And as a matter of fact, Hefner, one night, I remember we were sitting around in the kitchen. He loves to come down at 4 o'clock in the morning and sit there unshaven wearing his bathrobe and sit around with a few of his old friends who were with the magazine in the early days. And one night he said, we're sitting there eating pumpkin pie, which he happens to have a thing for, and he says, you know, what I really enjoy, he says, I enjoy guys who will risk it all. He says, you know, he says, I will go for a guy. He says, I like people who will say, why write for the Chelsea Shopping News? I'm going to send it in to, you know, sure. And he'll risk total humiliation. Yeah. And I said, well, Hef, you know, anybody that will go out on the kind of financial limbs that Hefner will, he'll loot like he started, remember Showbiz Illustrated?
Right. Yeah.
It's the only flop, really.
Yeah, but the point is, he will, and he'll quit, you see. He'll lose $500,000 on a thing like that, or maybe $1 million.
And he'll go right out. A good million on that.
Yeah, I know
it.
You think
a lot of money. Yeah.
This
great
will destroy a lot of men. With Hefner, he says, well, you win some, you lose a couple.
John pointed out about maybe a year ago, that if Joe Schultz, the corner grocer, goes into bankruptcy for $500 or $1,000, it's hard for him to get credit. But if an international financier, you know, who's dropped $10 million and is bankrupt, he gets it again.
Always his partner's in line to be with this guy because he was an operator who could build up a thing.
You know, John, there's certain guys, though, and when I say a Howard Hughes or a Hefner.
How about a Ralph Kaufman?
Or a Petty.
Kaufman especially.
Yeah, Ralph Kaufman in Cleveland.
Getty is one. Now,
yep.
You see, there's a difference between these men.
And Getty cares about money, though.
Well, now, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You see, Getty cares about money because money represents the chips that show he's won the game. And I think that we shouldn't confuse these guys with guys who will come along and briefly make a big fortune, let's say, in the construction business, overextend themselves, and 20 minutes later they're either in jail or they're back in Indianapolis at their hot dog stand. Now, a guy like Hefner works in all directions. In short, he's liable to tomorrow morning say, you know what we ought to do? We ought to start an airline. And he will throw $2 million into this thing.
He's done that. He's bought a plane. That's
right.
He's bought a commercial jet plane.
Don't be surprised if he doesn't come up with an airline.
I would not be. You're right.
That reminds me of my director, Howard Baer. Howard Baer, for a long while, when he was taking people on the tours around NBC, he just decided he wouldn't do it until the uniform was getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And then he decided to discard it. And he worked his way up to the top. Really.
You mean your show?
He was working at the RCA building for a while.
You mean the top floor.
Got right on the top floor. Went all the way up.
Amen.
Here we are.
The oral backing.
Yes. Bless you real good. Here we are back again with our guest.
One of my favorite lines of his is this one where he says, friends, I want you to just reach out now and lay your hands on that radio of yours.
Oral.
That's what I said, Oral Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
You said
Billy Graham.
No, I said,
Oral.
No, lay your hands on that radio of yours, and you feel that heat coming up through your knuckle bones, coming up through your elbow joints. Friends, that is electronic love I'm sending out your way.
I'm digging that right now. I want to
love offering, right?
Here. Something we've got to do here.
Well, right in front of the television screen.
A stone's throw from the famous Mountain Valley Spring. In the health resort region of Hot Springs, Arkansas, There's another spring whose water is delicious. Yet neither it nor any other spring has attained the widespread demand of Mountain Valley water. The difference is, there's something exceptional about Mountain Valley water. And if you said it was low in sodium, or the natural purity of Mountain Valley water, you wouldn't have all the answer. Other springs claim these, yet don't fill the bill. Believe me when I tell you this, that there's something exceptional, and complete satisfaction is what you receive from drinking a marvelous water of proven merit. 100 years of increasing popularity and the widest acceptance in America. Mountain Valley water promises that it will be just as good to taste and as good for you every day of your life. Yes, Mountain Valley water from the famous spring in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Do you know that it's protected by nature from any semblance of urban waste, detergents, pesticides, or other pollutants? This just begins to tell the story of Mountain Valley water. No water crisis was needed for it to win friends, because for 100 years, Mountain Valley water has increased in popularity, and today its acceptance is the widest in America. Now, I would like to send you a booklet that'll give you all of the facts about Mountain Valley water. Just put Mountain Valley on a card and send it to me, Long John Neville, WNBC, New York, 10020. Do that today, please. And I'll send you a brochure. There's no cost, no obligation. Or you can pick up your phone right now and dial Plaza 7-7210, PL7-7210. That's an answering service. Do that now. I'll put your name and address on a card and send it to me, Long John Neville, WNBC, New York, 10020.
January 29th, Dr. Joyce Brothers invites you to Radio Premiere Week on WNBC, New York.
When I say cradle, what do you think of? Protectiveness, comfort, care? Well, that's why T.O. Day, America's leading foot comfort specialist, call their special inner mold shoes Cradle Inner Molds. Cradle Inner Molds, they pamper your feet whole, protect, cushion, and comfort them to make walking a pleasure again. Cradle Inner Mold shoes are developed from impressions of your own feet. And they're available in the latest styles for men and women. And they keep your foot problems a secret. But what a difference they can make in your comfort, in your outlook, in your enjoyment of life's worthwhile activities. T.O. Day, that's spelled D-E-Y. They have the entire floor, the third floor of 509 Fifth Avenue. Yes, the home of Inner Mold Shoes, crafted right on the premises to meet your exact needs and tastes. Now, some people get up in the morning, and they claim it's going to rain today without even listening to Big Wilson, without even looking out the window. They base this on the fact that that little sore, aching corn on the small toe hurts this morning. That means it's going to rain. Well, if that's the only way you can tell what the weather's going to be, keep your corn. Or you may have a callus in the ball of the foot, or a bunion that throbs with pain just like that of a toothache, that you really can't stand the weight of a bedsheet on it. Well, when you go to T.O. Day, you may not be able to tell whether it's going to rain today. Well, one thing you can do, you can walk with pleasure. Because you'll be wearing shoes that have secret inner molds. T.O. Day, they'll be delighted to give you a free shoe analysis. And I mean just that, a free shoe analysis. I'd suggest that you call in advance for an appointment. They'll not try to sell you anything. They'll tell you what it's about and show you. Now, the number to call is MU24790. Murray Hill 2-4790. Or just send a card to me, Long John Neville, WNBC, New York, 10020, and put T-O-D-E-Y on the card,
and I'll have a brochure sent to you with all of the facts. Here we are back again with our guests, and we have Sanford Teller with us. Of Sanford Teller, public relations.
Communications.
I'm sorry, I bombed it already.
Oh, there it goes. Well,
and,
back to Ritter and Fennett.
Robert Kochner, managing editor of Newspaper Enterprise Association. How's that, Al?
Excellent.
And we have Dick Raskin, who joined us tonight. Dick is from California, and he plays a little guitar and a couple of other things. And we've got Gene Shepherd. Gene wrote the book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, which was published by Doubleday, but now available in paperback by Bantam Books. You know, I think the worst publicists, except for maybe a half a dozen, are people with book publishers.
I agree.
It's an old-fashioned industry. There's still
a few outstanding. Sonia Leventhal of McGraw-Hill. Letty Cotton of Bernard Geis. Gene Booth of Doubleday.
Yeah, there's
Abby Brown and her husband Tom Cassidy. Terry Garrity does a great job.
Most of
Lisa Kane.
Yeah.
From Harper's. But and I don't like to leave anybody out. I may have
probably
missed some.
Missed
but
a couple,
there are so many. It would take an hour and a half to say those that have no idea, that have never been to a show, that have no idea what happens at the show, who mislead the authors. I don't think they do it intentionally, but they have an idea because maybe they've heard Barry Gray, and they figure if you're on at night, I must be doing the same show that Barry, and they send the author up for 20 minutes, and a guy comes up and you say, will I be able to get a cab? And you say, gee, I really don't know. We'll try to help you when we leave in the morning. Well, I have to catch the 12:37 from Grand Central.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the guy, he's not putting me on, you know what I mean? He's not trying to be a wise guy or anything. But he was told that he would be on for 15 or 20 minutes.
At the top of the show.
At the top of the show, and that's the end of it.
Even worse is to run into a PR person from a publishing house who has not read the book.
That's not true.
And furthermore, I've seen some very embarrassing moments from like that around radio stations where publicity person will come in and start talking about a book to somebody, and the guy will turn and say, well, it isn't like that at all. I read it. The guy he's explaining it to knows more about it than he does.
Well, I always think that the extent of book promotion, generally speaking, is sending a book to a reviewer. That's as far as it goes.
Well, I've been around, you know, every time John gives me a chance to go through some of the books, I mean, just to see what the releases, press releases look like and things of that sort. I'm appalled that a major publisher will send out a major book with a form letter pitching it to all radio and TV.
And is it fun?
Sure.
I mean, it is so bad. Some of them are Xerox. and then they'll put Dear Mr. Neville or Dear John.
Dear Broadcaster.
Dear Broadcaster.
I love that one.
They do.
Dear Communicator.
Dear Broadcaster. And it says, we know this book will be of interest to your particular audience. You know
another one? Yeah. Can you imagine a show like we do and a person will send, if you would be interested, contact us and tell us when you would like the author and we'll send you a book. In the meantime, they send you the jacket.
Yeah, the jacket copy and all that.
And they want to know whether you're going to be interested. And of course, the jacket has nothing to do with the author. The author has had a thing to say about the jacket. And it's really, there's another gal by the name of Gia Moonjean. Is that it? Gia Moonjean, yeah.
Is that first name, last name? Both names?
I don't know what it is. But
sounds great.
She does a very, very fine job for Grosset and Dunlap and a couple of other friends. She's a very talented gal. But the gal who really has it and who is in business for herself is Terry Garrity.
Mm.
She does a great, great job.
Well,
very
talented.
Gene, I think we should go into one thing that a lot of people are completely unfamiliar with. I mean, some people have been listening to you maybe for 2, 3, 5 years. But a lot of people don't know about iLibertine. And I'd like to have you rehash that story. We've never done it on the air.
No, I don't think we have.
Never had. And that is a great story. Are you familiar with the iLibertine story?
I have to be refreshed. I don't recall the whole
thing. Do it, Gene. Tell us how the whole thing
started.
That's quite a story. This is very strange. It was a progression of peculiar events that led to an international, in fact, a worldwide story. I'm surprised you don't remember it. Maybe you will remember it when you're refreshed on it. But when I first came to New York, Bob, I was on all night on WOR. And
You started from 11:15 to 11:30.
Well, that was very briefly, but actually, when I first...
With the Handy Sandy Andy and the Jawbreakers and all.
Yeah, but when I really got started in New York, I got on, and I was on all night, really. I was on from midnight till 5 in the morning.
That was familiar.
Yeah.
And, well, actually, John played a role in that event. It was a very interesting event, and I was on late at night. I was broadcasting from the transmitter at WOR.
Not in Carteret.
Yeah, and in those days, this really was a turning point in radio, although at the time nobody really knew it. In those days, radio was a very, very formatized form of entertainment. It was format all the way down the line. And the formats, there were disc jockeys, and they had a stranglehold on the industry. And, radio really was an adjunct of the music business. And then there were a few newscasters on. That was about the extent of it. And I had come out of the Midwest, and I had an idea that radio as a personal form of communication, a personal artistic medium, in other words, to use radio to say things and to do things which have a very personal meaning for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not plugging Pat Boone's records or interviewing some lady who draws pictures on velvet of cats. I used radio the same way that a writer uses a sheet of paper to say what he has to say about the world. Well, this was very peculiar. It's not really been done, and I was on late at night, and the time was a very peculiar time. It was during the time of Eisenhower, and there was a lot of, it was the beginning, the very beginnings of what later became known as the black comedy period in America. Satire was unknown. There was a lot of comedy. Today we call comedy satire. There is really still very little satire around. Most people today call a comic a satirist. Not so. And also, I don't consider a man who does political gags a satirist. That's often called a satirist. Mm-hmm. He's really just a polemicist. But I'm on late at night, and I'm doing this stuff and working away 7 days a week, and it was hot. It was the middle of summer. And I was new in New York, and I suddenly became aware that New York is almost entirely a city that really does run on lists. The first time I really ran into the hit syndrome, that if Brooks Atkinson, who was writing in those days, said a show was a hit, it was a hit.
Mm-hmm.
If he said it was good, even if the people who went to see it fell asleep. And they thought they were failing Brooks Atkinson. I was fascinated by this, you see. And in New York, the 10 best dressed people are talked about on the radio all over New York, and television. And they don't even think about this in Cleveland or Cincinnati. It's a New York phenomenon. And it just began to interest me. And one night, late at night, I'm on the air, and I said, you know, has it ever occurred to you, friends, that these lists are compiled by mortals, and that they are human just like you are, and in fact, they have many more access to grain than you. Now, we all laugh at, say, the Academy Awards. Have you ever been asked to vote on the best movie? All we do is sit, and somebody hands somebody else a statue, and that's the best movie of the year. And I said, is it really? Is it really?
You're not supposed to think that way.
I know it. And I'm doing this stuff late at night. And I says, now I'll carry it even further. I said, no matter who you are in New York, you're influenced by these lists. I said, you may laugh at the one that's in the Daily News because you read the Times. And somehow, if it says the top 10 bestsellers in the New York Times, you really do think. You may never have even seen a copy of those bestsellers. Because it's in the Times, it's authentic. I said, has it occurred to you that there's a little guy who is bugged because for 4 years he was on obituaries And he's always had this dream of being Walter Lippmann, 17 years, and now he's got this desk, and all he does every Monday is call these little schlock book dealers around town and says, "How, what's selling this week, man?" And I says, "Now, let's take it even further. You'll read this little thing at the bottom." He says, "This is a list that is made up of, let's say, 422 authentic books that he deals." I says, "Well, let's go back to the book dealer." And so we go into the bookstore, and here's this guy, this Fred Appelrod, he's the book buyer, see, and he bought 500 copies of Who Shot John?
Yes.
3 months ago, and he's got 497 of them there.
Yes.
So,
boy, they're going.
Yeah, so he says to Mr. So-and-so who calls, "Why, Who Shot John is moving here, I'll tell you, there's nothing like it." I said, four or five other guys say the same thing, and the next thing you know, Who Shot John is number four.
Yes.
And all the people who believe in list rush out like mad and buy it. And then it becomes an authentic.
This is true. True,
of course it's true. Yeah. Well, people were calling up and they said, "This is ridiculous. How can this be? What do you mean? You know, this is an authentic list." And I says, "All right, I'll tell you what let's do, friend." And this is 3 o'clock in the morning. I says, "Now, the people who believe in lists are asleep." I says, "Because they get up at 7 o'clock bright and bushy tailed to run down to the agency, they buy all the hit show tickets, you know, they really love Barbra Streisand and all this." And I said, "And anybody who's sitting up here at 3 o'clock in the morning secretly has doubts." because a lot of us still got to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. And while you're sitting here at 3 o'clock in the morning listening to me, I says, "There's only two kinds of people, us and them. And they don't know we exist."
We're back again. Back to the story of High Liberty.
You really want to hear this?
Oh, it's so great.
Because I don't like to take over the microphone here. We're all sitting around kidding around tonight. But that story taught me a lesson, Bob, that I'll never forget. Dick, it taught a lot of people a lesson. Because I was just sitting here talking about things. You know, it was a theoretical thing. Now, remember, this is 10 years ago when people did, they accepted things like bestseller lists as actually authentic. The top 40 tunes to a person listening, he says, that must be the top 40. And I had learned a lesson earlier on that. I remember a guy once in Cincinnati who by public relations, one thing and another, he had a record on the top 30 tunes in the, quote, Bible of showbiz before it was even published. It had never even been published. Here it was number 8. So all the disc jockeys across the country, you see, would get this Bible and say, "Well, it must be big in Pittsburgh. I haven't gotten my copy yet." Well, sure enough, when they turned it out, every DJ in the country played played the pants off this record because it was number 3 and number 6, and then it became number 1 authentically. Well, the public, I guess, is not aware of the chicanery that goes into these lists and what they do mean to books and they mean to films, one thing or another. There's millions riding on that, and you and I all know that when millions are riding on things, that's when the operations get big. So I'm doing this thing late at night. And that was simultaneously, Bob, at the time that I created a term. You know, it's kind of an eerie feeling to have created a term that has entered the language. Now, you know, you read terms like hot diggity dog. Can you imagine the guy that first said that?
Yeah, whack-a-ding-hoy.
Well, no, I mean the one who first said it. He created something that has entered the language, like... oh, gosh, somebody must have said that the first time. Well, I actually created a term that you see on billboards, you read it in page papers all the time, and it came about on that show. This is 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Look," and it just hit me out of the blue. I said, "You know, there's two kinds of people. I've just been thinking about this, really. There's the kind of guy who believes in the world of the office. He really believes in file cabinets. He believes in luncheons. He believes that the day, the time from 8 a.m. to 6 in the evening is the time he's alive. The phone call, the lunch, the appointment. And the time after that is just dead time. He flops down in front of the TV set. He drinks his beer. He goes to sleep.
Just waiting for the next day.
I said, now that is a day person. His world is the day world. But there's the other guy whose world begins the minute he gets out of that office. And his time is at 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 in the morning. He's his own private world. He's a night person. I created the term night person, and you will find it in the American Dictionary of Slang and Usage, and they credit me with it. And I said, and of course, the opposite number is the day person, and they're constantly battling. Only they don't know that they are. So you're sitting in this sales meeting, and here is this guy sitting over here, and he's got this light of ecclesiastical fervor. He believes in Operation Dynamo that you're about to foist on the public. He believes in it, see, and you're sitting there all...
William McCormick.
Yeah, that's right, Bill McCormick. And you're sitting over there, is this guy serious? He really believes in it? And you try to make a funny with him. He says, well, you know, remember what happened to Operation Over the Top? And he looks at you. You know. Well, of course, if it hadn't been for Fred and accounting, that would have gone over. Well, there's the battle, you see, going on. And I said, now, let's face it, it's the day people who buy lists. They are statistically oriented, and they will not go to a hit show unless there is a line of over 100 in front of that box office. I mean, it could be the worst turkey in the world. If they read in the paper it costs $20 to get a ticket, that's better than a $1 ticket. They're oriented to money. A $5,000 car must be five times better than a $1,000 car, even if the transmission is made out of balsa wood. It's got to be better. Now, that's the statistical mind, and he is the day man. So I said, now, if you think I'm kidding, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, the day man is not listening to us. He can't consider. He thinks we're nuts. He says, he's listening to me, and he says, what's this not talking about? And he goes off, and he gets WPAT on, you know, with that nice Mondovani record, you know, this the opiate for the masses, see? And I said, I'll tell you what let's do. I says, if you think I'm kidding, I said, what do you say tomorrow morning, each one of us, walk into a bookstore and ask for a book that we know does not exist? We're going to create it here. It does not exist. Walk into a bookstore and ask for a book that we know does not exist. We're going to create it here. It does not exist. Let's just see what happens. Because the day man will believe that it is. And let's see how it works. I said, now look, since we're all in this together, what do you say now? We're going to make this a communal affair. And I'm not... You give me a suggestion for a title. Just call it in. And millions of calls. They were coming from, you know, at night, the 50,000-watt station at 4 in the morning. I'm getting calls from Alaska. And these guys are giving me all these suggestions for titles. And finally, at 4:30 in the morning, it was getting so late, I had to go off at 5:30. I said, okay, it's closed. I picked the title. And some unknown guy called in this title, I, Libertine. I said, now that sounds like a book. I mean, it could be almost anything. I, comma, Libertine. I said, now, I'm going to create... You got to have an author. Because today, you know, most people, you know, they say, if you read the newest Faulkner, Jacqueline Suzanne's a big deal, you know. You've got to have an author. All right, I'll create an author. And I sat for a minute. And it just hit me, the name. I says, okay, the author's name is Frederick Ewing. Frederick Roland Ewing. He's British. He was a lieutenant commander in World War II on the North Atlantic, the Murmansk Run. He is now a civil servant in Rhodesia. He is married to Marjorie, a horsewoman from the North Country. He writes extensively for The Observer, and he is known primarily for his pre-World War II broadcast on the third program of the BBC, 18th Century Erotica. And he's a scholar, and I, Libertine is the first volume of a trilogy on 18th century English court life. And by the way, Mr. Ewing is quite surprised at the success his book is enjoying, since it was written primarily for scholars. Those people do not misunderstand certain chapters that are there for the purpose of scholarly research. And I said, just go in and say, I, would like Ewing's High Liberty. I says, and if anybody asked you, it was printed by Excelsior Press,
yeah,
which, by the way, is a subsidiary of Cambridge University Imprint. I said, there is not a bookseller in the country that can argue with Cambridge and a British author who's married to a lady named Marjorie. I says, now you go in and don't crack a smile. Don't do anything. And when the man says to you, the first thing, I says, he's also bound by lists. The first thing he'll do, you'll walk in and say, I would like to have a copy of I, Libertine by Frederick Ewing. And he'll say, who published it? You say, Excelsior Press. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Just a moment. And he'll take out a list, and he'll look it up, and he'll see that it is not listed. He will turn to you and say, there's no such book. You say, well, I'll go to Doubleday's then, and leave. Well, the next guy that comes in and asks for this, he'll say, it's on order. And the third one that comes in, he's going to be on his phone calling the distributor.
Yeah.
And the distributor's going to say to him, you're out of your bird, Fred. You're being put on. There's no such book. I've got the big list here. And there's nothing like that. Well, if 422 bookstores call in, he's going to be calling Publishers Weekly. And within 20 minutes, Publishers Weekly has collapsed in a pile of rubble. And remember, it's a $6.95 book. They don't laugh at a $7 book. I says, now get out and go, and we'll sit back and see what happens. Now, remember, every listener knew that book did not exist. And they knew it didn't exist. I says, now remember, it does not exist. You know this, and let's see what happens. And I says, you let me know tomorrow morning and the day after that, give me reports, and I will give them out to the listeners what's happening. Sure enough, the next day a guy says, you know, he says, For years, this guy in this A Street bookstore with his beard has had me totally buffaloed. I mean, he stands back of that cash register, and you have a feeling that he wrote Kierkegaard. That he was behind Schopenhauer when Schopenhauer wrote this stuff. And he says, you know, he used to say things like this. I'd go in and I'd say, something about Marcel Proust. And he says, well, of course, Proust never matured. And he says, you know, I went in there today, and I said to this guy, I'd like a copy of I, Libertine by Ewing. And he says, he looked up from behind the cash register and said, Ewing, it's about time the public discovered him. He says, the scales fell from my eyes. He says, I learned something. And I'm getting these calls from people. One woman wrote in, and she, 2 days later, she says she was sitting in her bridge party, and she just casually mentioned, gee, I've been reading I, Libertine. And three ladies started to discuss it. They not only had read it, they finished it, and two of them didn't like it. And so she says, it was all that. She says, then I got a letter from a kid at 2 weeks later. They're coming in from all over the country saying what's happening is that people are hearing this, you know, airline pilots were listening. It was spreading to Paris, Rome, Japip, every place else. And a guy wrote me a letter. He says, Shepard, he says, don't say anything about this. He says, look at this. And he enclosed in this envelope, he says, I'm a student at a university, which I shall not name. It's in Jersey. I'll pick a pen name. Let's think of some funny name. Rutgers. He was a student at this non-existent school called Rutgers thing. And he says, I'm in this English, this history of English writing course. And he said, I wrote a term paper on F.R. Ewing, Eclectic Historian. And it was about a 9-page paper with footnotes, quotes from Ewing's earlier BBC broadcasts, references. And the thing, he sent it to me, and it had a big red thing on the front of it. It said, superb research. He got a B+.
Always a B+.
Yeah.
Never an
A. And the guy says, what? He says, my whole education is probably phony. He says, I'll bet there wasn't even a Chaucer. You know, this could have been some guy 400 years ago, you know, putting the whole world on. So all of it. And I says, wait, let's sit back. I says, don't say anything. Just keep asking. Well, do you know within 4 weeks there was a piece appeared in the Earl Wilson column? It said, had lunch with Freddie Ewing. On his way to India with his wife Marjorie.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding you. You know, and I begin to get frightened, you know, because It's like a guy who stands at the base of a mountain, and he says to himself, gee, I wonder what would happen if I threw a pebble up there. And he throws one up there, and the next thing you know, he's got a 420 trillion ton avalanche coming down on him. You know, it's just incredible. This thing pyramided. And so I began to get all over. Do you know that at the end of the sixth week, one of the funniest things that happened, that one of the book supplements, at that time there were three book supplements published with Sunday newspapers in New York. There was the New York Times book supplement, and there were two others. One of the book supplements had a review of I, Libertine.
How could that have happened?
Well, now, here's what I said. Now, wait a minute. Now that goes into later. Now, this is the truth. I've got it all in clippings.
I know it's the truth.
Now, how it happened was my listeners all over the place, even book reviewers, were foisting it on people.
Oh.
They were calling up editors, I'd like to review this new book. And see, listeners were beginning to throw their... And I says, any place you can throw your little hooker in, let's do it and see what happens. So some PR man wrote to one of the columnists, and next thing you know, they're having lunch with Freddie Ewings. Well, these comments about Ewing began to appear all over in the newspapers. And the final upshot of it all was, I'm getting letters from people. He says, you know, the other day my boss asked me if I read it. He says, what do I say? So my boss reads all the book club books. And he's waiting for it to come in the book club, you know. And the boss, he says, it's all this stuff. And one day, the final one, it scared me. I, Libertine, was on the proscribed list. It was banned by a very prominent church.
I was going to remain nameless.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I didn't know.
By the
Boston
Diocese. No, this blew the gaff. I said, and my listeners are staggering. You know, and what do you think? At the end of the seventh week, it is on a nationwide bestseller list.
But, Gene, just to interject one, do you mean that it's possible that several hundred
people... I'm telling you what happened.
Yeah, but 700 people then could have been excommunicated
for reading
the book.
That's right. Let me then see, you're killing the story, but that I'm telling you what happened. This is not a thing for gags. This is just exactly a historical thing. And I'm sitting back there, and all this stuff is happening, see. And about, I'd say, 2 o'clock on a Wednesday or a Thursday morning, and this has been going for 8 weeks now, that it is now a bestseller in Paris, in Rome. They're asking for it in bookstores. They're asking for it in places like Honolulu, everywhere, all over. And the people who are asking for it, remember, know that it doesn't exist. That's the important point.
Right.
They are sitting back and watching the repercussions. And here it is, you know, there's no mentions of the book in all kinds of columns and everywhere of people who think it does exist. I says, remember, friends, they think it does. And when we were banned in Boston by a very prominent church, I mean, our whole world was crumbling. You see, I mean, by now I was a little afraid, you know, next thing you know, the president's going to mention it, you know, that he loves this book. See, then I wouldn't believe in anything, you know. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I get a telephone call, and this guy gets on the phone, very funny voice, and he says, look, he says, Shep, he says, you know, you're right. You touched on something very important. There are two kinds of people in this country, the believers and us. And he said, I am a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And he says, I've listened to this thing from the beginning. He says, it's incredible. And by the way, we had even had an editorial in Life. And he said, this is fantastic. And he says, don't you think it's about time to spill the story? And I said, yeah, I think so. I said, this is getting out of hand. And so he came down to the office, and I showed him all this documentary proof. And he went back to his office, and he worked on this piece. And on Wednesday afternoon, on this August, hot August day, it appeared front page, middle, 2-3-column banner. It says, gigantic literary hoax. Shows the real phoniness behind a lot of the things that people believe in, like lists and so on. And he had the whole thing documented. Well, that came out on the newsstands at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was sitting in my office. It was fantastic. At 3:01, I would say with it between 301 and 305, there were six countries on the phone calling me about that. Melbourne was calling. Rome was calling. Newspaper editors, Figaro, the German newspapers, everywhere. It was a fantastic story. And that story, it's probably one of the very few stories that has ever been printed, word for word, taken out of the Wall Street Journal and reprinted in Pravda. It was printed exactly word for word. Well, this thing just blew to the point where people were calling from all over. And then, it was never, at any point, was there any PR involved. It was a whole series of forces that came together. And I think that time, that particular year, was the beginning of the whole new attitude that people have today towards things which they never questioned. People today question politicians. They never did, really. They used to say things about it, but today they really question. People look at things, and it was the beginning, and I'm not saying that started it. I'm saying that was the beginning of a whole thing. After that, Mort Saul grew, and Lenny Bruce, and the whole thing changed over almost in that period overnight. It just began to mushroom.
Isn't there more to that story about the book?
Oh, there's much more, but we don't have that time.
Am I crazy, or did I read that somebody eventually wrote a book?
No, later then. You see, when it was...
Later on, about a...
See, you're going ahead again. One day, a friend of mine, a writer, Ted Sturgeon called me one day and said, listen, he says, you know, he says, there's this publisher who... He says, he's a paperback publisher, and he says, you have got him taken. He said, this guy is going around all over the world trying to get the paperback reprints, rights on I Liberté. And so he says, let's have lunch with him. And he says, let's have kicks. So I sat down with him, and he says, we were eating lunch, and he turns to him, and he said, listen, he said, would you like to meet, the publisher was Ian Ballantyne. Ballantyne, he said, would you like to meet I Liberté? Would you like to meet Fred Ewing? And Ian is a very innocent type guy. He says, yeah, he says, I certainly would. He says, I've been very interested in meeting him. And he says, well, here he is, sitting right here. And that lunch, we decided, he says, well, let's turn out I Liberté. And all the day people will buy it. The night people will know. we took all the profits of the thing, by the way, and turned it over to charity, in case you're interested.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It was not a commercial deal in any sense of the word. So we put this baby on, and sure enough, we're together. He and I, we banged this thing out, you know, we're sitting at it, and it became a bestseller, genuinely, after that. But the whole progression of this thing. So, now, in America, this is, and then the further lesson that all of my listeners learned was the way it was reported in the press. It says things like, disc jockey sells non-existent book to listeners. Exactly the reverse. The listeners sold a non-existent book to the world. It was a very, and they went on. You know, they didn't want to admit.
They haven't had, yeah.
Well, no, not that they got took. That the thing was a comment on the entire structure of the official critic, the official layer down of the 8 best-dressed people. Newspapers go for this kind of stuff. The 10 best-seller books. They're the final...
It still happens today, though.
Yeah. It still does. Joe, it never changed. Don't go into that. We know that it still goes today. But I'm saying this is why it was never reported and analyzed for what it really was, except overseas, that the British press loved this. And just a few years ago, that story, which you don't even remember, interestingly enough, it's been forgotten in America, but all over the world it is recognized as a real comment on the public relations world, the world of the glib newspaper writer, the whole thing of the official lists. And the Daily Express of London a few years ago picked the 50 greatest hoaxes of the 20th century up to that time, which was 1962 or 63. And I Libertine, they gave it a great big spread. It was one of the great hoaxes of all time. So it wasn't just a little gag that it had overseas. Now, many times we've heard the story of somebody who creates a non-existent thing and gets little plugs in the paper and all that. But that's not what we did. This was very different. And when your book is banned, That's something else.
Much reviewed. It's
yeah, and by the way, if all this is documented, Time magazine did a big story.
I remember the whole thing.
Newsweek did a big story in Life. This was all afterwards, you know, on the actual story. But none of them really touched on the meaning of the story because that was still too early. If this thing had happened today, I think people are much more aware. Even the writers, and they would make the moral of this thing. But the moral was never mentioned in any of the pieces, except in the Wall Street Journal.
And outside the country.
Yeah, and outside the country. But it was a fantastic story.
It's a great story.
And I think a lot of people who are involved in it, I'm talking about listeners and so on, who are involved during that whole progression of events, never were the same in their lives after that. They never could seriously sit and watch the Academy Awards. Or even polls. They read the Harris poll. It says, Charlie Brown leads Fred Appelrod by 0.2%. These things like you pick up TV Guide and it says, Ed Sullivan has 37.9 yards.
Yeah, sure. Right.
That it shook everybody. Only in America, by the way, do we place such importance on these abstract numbers as to whether Bonanza is 0.2% higher than the Smothers Brothers.
Not only that, numbers right through government. You remember that book 10, 15 years ago, How to Lie with Statistics?
Yeah. Well, people aren't lying. They're just totally fallacious. They don't. It's not a matter of lying.
January 29th, Bill Mazur invites you to Radio Premiere Week on WNBC New York.
I don't know if you believe in flying saucers or not, but a very good friend of mine, Frank Edwards, has written some of the great books. And incidentally, for your information, in case you're unaware of it, well, one of the most sensational sellers in the flying saucer field, it was on the best-selling list for so many weeks, was a book written by Frank Edwards titled Flying Saucer Serious Business. Right now, a brand new book has been published. Frank Edwards, Flying Saucers Here and Now. Now, this book brings you up to date with the new and startling developments in the unidentified flying objects mystery since January 1966. There is no book on the market today that is as up to date as Frank Edwards' new book titled Here and Now. Let me take a moment of your time to tell you about some of the goodies in this book. In this book, Frank Edwards documents UFO sightings by a Florida governor, by scores of police officers, a Maryland newspaper editor, a New Orleans colonel, two Australian constables, eight members of the Royal Canadian Air Force, sightings by psychologists, astronomers, airline pilots, scientists, and by top executives of the largest commercial aircraft companies in the world. Now, included, there are a group of what I would like to label as just sensational photographs. These were taken by observers ranging from teenagers with Polaroids to astronauts with the space program's most sophisticated camera. And many of these are published for the first time, this information. And I would like to have you go to your favorite bookstore and get a copy of Frank Edwards' new book, Flying Saucers, Here and Now. It contains a wealth of information. Questions are answered, such as, where do the UFOs come from? That's right, Frank answers it in the new book titled, Flying Saucers, Here and Now. Is it true that UFOs are not tracked on radar? Well, read the book and you'll find out. Do we ever get pieces of UFOs? Yes, those questions and many others are answered in Frank Edwards' new book, Flying Saucers Here and Now. May I suggest to you to go to your favorite bookstore today and ask for Flying Saucers Here and Now by Frank Edwards.
Let me take just a moment to remind you that if you happen to get a copy of the Sunday News, which I have not got it yet because it isn't Sunday, but I understand that Ben Gross has written a story about the show, and many of our listeners might be interested in reading it. Ben Gross is the Dean of Radio and TV Editors. He's the man who's responsible for one of the best books ever written on the subject of radio and TV.
titled I Looked and I Listened. So it's in the issue dated January 21, New York Sunday News, this Sunday. If you have a chance, you might want to look at it. And now, back with our guests. Sanford Teller is with us. Mr. Teller is a public relations consultant. And we have Robert Kochner, who's managing editor of Newspaper Enterprise Association. And Dick Raskin, who is a college student and also a pretty good man on guitar. And we have Gene Shepherd, who's a well-known broadcaster, an actor, and an author. And in fact, his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, which was published by Doubleday, is now in softcover, paperback edition.
John, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that. Banter. I'm going to go back into... You remember I did Voice of the Turtle, you recall seeing
it? Yes, sure, I was there.
I'm going to go back into the theater more this coming year. I've got all kinds of plans, and several people have been talking to me about it. I haven't had time since I've been doing all this writing, you know. That's why I really kind of put down my acting career. But I love acting. I enjoy it tremendously. And I'm going to do some stuff this coming fall.
Something in particular that you want to mention now?
I can't yet. I can't say anything yet. Just suffice it to say, John, I'm sharpening up my tap dancing.
Well, very good.
Busty Berkeley back again.
Yes. You doing Off to Buffalo, a break?
Oh, no. This is more interpretive dance.
Oh, pardon me. Pardon me, Mr.
Purple
Shepherd.
Lights and the tights.
Thank
and
you, Mr. Shepherd.
You're not going to be in the Martha Graham Company, are you?
No.
He's not allowed to divulge at the moment what he is going to be doing. This is a secret. You know, Dick Raskin was a listener of yours and a fan of yours when he was going to high school. And, of course, then he went out to the coast for a while, and he just came back, and he got hooked recently listening to you again. When did you first start to listen?
Must have been in 19...
Can you get a little closer there, Dick?
In 59, when you were first on... When you were on before Long John was on.
Yeah. Well, that was later when John took over the all-night trick on WOR.
I took it over in 56.
Yeah, my show, I had a show from 11:15 till midnight.
Till midnight.
Yeah.
That was the one. I used to get scared to death. He did the end of the world one night, I think.
Yeah.
It scared the...
Well, I did the real end of the world, the way it really would be, as opposed to the science fiction way. I said, can you imagine?
What is the difference?
Well, there's a big difference, because it seems to be very innocent when you read it in... And kind of exciting when you read it in science fiction. But I did a show one night based on, can you imagine what would happen if the world really was ending? And you were there. and I reproduced it. By the way, Dick, John says you play guitar and you're out on the coast. What do you think of the coast as opposed to the East Coast, since you're living and have lived in both places?
I love the coast. It's a different kind of thing. It's a little bit... To me, easier going. Because I've been in school. I'm not too involved in, you know, the life anywhere, I guess, academically.
Yeah.
You get out of what's really happening. But you come back to New York, and all of a sudden things seem to speed up again. And trying to get involved in it is a little difficult because I've been gone.
Your pace has changed, too.
Yeah.
I'm on the coast.
Yeah,
they talk fast here.
Yeah, I can't understand it.
What school do you go to?
I go to Valley College there.
Valley?
It's a junior college. They've got a fantastic system. It's better than New York. I like the educational system out there. And I don't know, I like the coast better than New York. Everything has its good points, you know, that's sacred.
Yeah.
This is, on a few point scales, better. It's strange to be back in New York, but just to see places, see the changes. To me, it's an amazing city. New York always has been. But they're just the theater. The one
it
thing
is
I
a
miss,
peculiar mistake, New York. It really is.
You know, it's funny. You know, you talk about going back into acting again.
Yeah.
When I came out here, the theater in New York can't be beat. I mean, there's no place in the world, because I love theater. I was raised in New York, and to go to Broadway and see a good show, you know, not necessarily because the critics
and have your choice of all kinds of things to do.
You don't see many good shows nowadays, though, do you? On Broadway or off Broadway? I don't. You say the theater in New York. I'm wondering if it's really the place where things are happening in the theater.
Well, Bob, they've always said that about New York theater, though. You know, it's funny. If you go back to the 1890s, you read editorials saying the theater is dying. And in any given year...
Oh, yes, you hear that again and again, but I'm just wondering if this, there's something... I've never said the theater is dying in New York. I don't know if I'm prepared to, but I've seen theaters outside the city, repertory companies, for example. What's his name? The one in, I think, in Milwaukee is one. Or the Washington, the Guthrie, yeah. The Guthrie Theater. And the Washington
Well, Bob, maybe it's a matter of definition. I think the New York theater isn't really theater. It's showbiz. This is a very different thing. What David Merrick is doing is really... we have to make that differentiation
That's
between
true.
Theater and showbiz. And New York is... After all, millions ride on shows in New York, and they don't in Milwaukee. And I'm certainly not condoning the showbiz mystique in New York, but it is showbiz. And when you bring a show in that costs $297,000 just to get on a stage... you're not as much concerned with art as you are with box office because you have a lot of people to answer.
Why is it then that so many of these $297,000 shows fail in the first few days?
Well, because they're not good. Because, you see, this even if they only pay $24 to put the show on, they might fail. Money is no criterion of it, but this is a big roulette wheel here in New York, showbiz really has taken over much greater in 1968 than it was, say, prevalent in 1958, we'll say, because costs have gone up. And that no longer is there such a thing as the little show. It's impossible. So you take even if you see a show on Broadway that there's only two characters, these two characters are drawing down very heavy cash. The rent on the theater, the whole thing. So there's no such thing as bringing in a show for $23,000.
Not on Broadway itself.
Not on Broadway. Sure, we're talking about Broadway.
We just changed the subject here because of a telegram that came in. Long John, this is from an old friend, by the way, of the show, a name that Shep will remember. Long John, Shep is also a beautiful draftsman. Would appreciate some of his comments on the current art scene. And signed, Arnold Berger.
Oh, thank you, Arnold.
Arnold, great artist.
He's referring to the fact that one of my activities, I hesitate to use the word artist because I'd rather use that, but I do line drawings and I've done stuff for The Voice and for Doubleday. And Arnold's a fine sculptor, by
Tremendous,
the way.
Yeah.
Excellent. And, Arnold, I can say what art scene.
Let me ask you you would comment about Andy Warhol, for example.
Oh, well, I don't think... Let's not confuse popularity with art.
No, in other words, Warhol today is commercial. I'm not saying it's art. Are you saying it's not art?
Well, there's that age-old argument as what constitutes art. And like a lot of other words in our language, the word art has gone through a rapid transition in maybe 10 years. And today, the word art, people use it to even describe insurance selling. They'll call it the art of salesmanship.
Right, you're right. Art of love.
Yeah, everything is an art today.
Yeah.
So when you talk about Warhol, you have to say Warhol is also a product of this time, that anything is art if you want to call it that. And if enough people say it is, then for them, briefly, for that time, it is.
Right.
But I say that this stuff is as transient. Because you look at a Warhol today. Warhol is strangely old-fashioned. Warhol,
you mean the old soup can stuff.
No, I don't mean his content. I mean the concept. Warhol is as out of date, believe me, as September Morn.
Now, somebody else said that about it.
Well, it's true.
On the show, too.
That's the thing with pop culture. Oh. See, pop culture is transitory culture. It has no genuine base. It's transitory.
Mm.
It's like a pop song. I often wonder, you hear all these hip records, and everybody says, they're all going on. I wonder what a pop record fan does with last year's records. Some people must have 227,000 records that they never conceivably play.
How would you classify the Beatles in all of this? Is there any kind of lasting power to the Beatles? The kind of records that you might have 5 years from now and play 5 years from now?
Personally, I don't think so.
Yeah.
See, we're making a great... today, pop, the word pop, and I'm in a pop medium, and incidentally,
yeah.
I know Marshall McLuhan has written about my show, so I'm in that world. And I think today we're getting very self-conscious about pop art. Mm-hmm. And so the most popular of the pop art is always considered great art. Hence, forever. Hence, it's supposed to have great lasting value. Well, this is kind of sad.
But, you know, on the other hand, it would seem that not until recently did people actually seriously look at the pop culture. I don't know whether...
Yeah, but that still doesn't make it any the less or any the more transitory. I've noticed that you take people like the Beatles and so on. I noticed that their earlier records are never played.
That's
which
right.
means then that their art, really, even within their own milieu, is transitory.
Of course, the other thing is, the other explanation is, well, now they've developed into art, you see, which they had their origins 5 years ago. Now it is art.
Well, now you're saying then that what they're cutting now, you will hear 10 years
I'm
from
not
now.
Saying that.
Well,
I'm not
remains
saying that.
To be seen.
Yeah.
See,
right.
at any given
that.
Time, I
Others
remember,
say that, yeah.
Look, I've had this same argument over and over again, Sandy, with people, and I keep saying to them, you know, there's no way for you to know. I remember one time having an argument with somebody in a radio station about Bill Haley.
Yeah.
And everybody said, well, you know, this is such a fantastically popular thing. It's really going to go on and on. Well, whoever hears of Bill Haley today?